Welcome to For the Love of Conversation, the podcast that grew out of 3 Minute Storyteller, where we believe conversations connect us and social change begins with the stories we tell. At 3 Minute Storyteller, we share digital stories, video snippets of intimate, messy, expansive conversations with a wildly eclectic bunch of artists, scientists, leaders of all stripes, all who are legendary change agents. Some you may know, and hopefully many you don't. This podcast is the opportunity to bring you into the full conversation. I'm Shannon Mannon, along with my husband Mike and our VW bus Scarlett, who we've outfitted into an awesome mobile storytelling unit. We invite you into the full conversation with us. We're so glad you're along for the ride. Ernest Owens is an award-winning journalist, contributor to CNN and NBC News, and LGBT editor of Philadelphia Magazine. As an industry captain of new media, Owens' searing social commentary often draws national attention. After all, he's the guy with a rabid Twitter following who got into it with Justin Timberlake after the BET Awards for his cultural appropriation of Black music. Our conversation reveals a warm and humorous Owens, where we learn that the moral fiber that undergirds his work was fostered by his summers spent with his grandmother in her rural Georgia town. Owens' lens as a Black gay man in a position of rising power offers a unique vantage point to discuss privilege, the betrayal he feels in both Black and queer communities, and what it takes to live a life where instead of changing for the world, he's doing all he can to urge the world to change for people like him. I kind of wanted to start a little bit at the beginning of your story.
Okay.
And get a sense of, you know, your childhood growing up, you know, down south, and if you just want to talk about that, however you would like to talk. I've read a little bit about kind of, you talk about coming out in three parts, and you've just got a really interesting childhood story.
So. You know, I had girlfriends and had girl crushes, but I knew that I was keeping something that a lot of people didn't know, and I didn't feel like I could share, you know. It's funny because I grew up, you know, my middle school years was around 2006, and it was a different era. And I think, you know, now looking in retrospect where we are now, and like we, you know, we're past the Obama era and all these different laws that's come in to be LGBTQ friendly. Back then, being gay was still in many ways illegal. And in many ways still is in parts of the country that don't have anti-discrimination policy. But at that time, you know, I knew I was gay. And I was popular amongst everything else, my academics, my grades, my social life. And I was scared that if I came out, you know, that this would be a burden to that. It would be a distractor. It would be what people would focus on. It's interesting when people say things like, oh, you know, why do everyone focuses on people's sexuality? And they say, you know, people in the LGBTQ community only talks about, you know, over-sexualize themselves. It's not us, we're regular people. It's the rest of the world that I think cares more about that than anything else. They, you know, and so I was very much so very private about it. So most of my years in middle school and even high school, I was very much so not out. It wasn't really until high school, my junior year, when I ran for class president, that I began to come out to some of my friends. And the way in which I campaigned about it during my campaign was like, you know, I might be gay, but I'm the smartest person in the room. When I look back at that, like, I was class president valedictorian my senior class. So I was both. And, you know, if I knew what I knew now, I realized that I shouldn't have had to feel this need to be overachieving in a way that kind of overcompensates or feel like it has to be a response to what I thought was a burden, which was my identity, my sexual orientation. And I thought that that was hard. And I think we all do that in different marginalized communities, whether you're a woman, whether you're, you know, of color. There's always this sense that if you're not a cisgender, heterosexual, white, Christian male, that you, for the most part, anything that's other has to be somewhat compromised or somewhat put to the side, or you have to make up for it in some kind of way. And so in many ways, I felt like I had to make up for my sexual orientation by having to say, hey, I might be gay, but I'm the smartest person in the room. At the time, I didn't come out to my family. I had came out to some of my friends back home. When I came to Penn, you know, it was a different experience altogether. It was, you know, this is a school where I learned a lot about the power of class. Growing up in the South, you know, I was in a school with mostly black and brown kids, mostly African American and Latinx, you know, kids. So when I came to Penn, it wasn't much of a culture shock in the way in which that hyper-competitive environment and the dynamics of race and class played a role. Most of the kids at Penn, their family come from wealth. They're like, you know, they go to Cancun for spring break. They go to Paris for winter break. They go to Russia for Easter. I mean, they just have money where they can just do whatever they want to do. And that experiencing that, like that class divide across all racial lines, was intense. My first semester, just adapting to like what it feels like to, for the first time really in my experience, know that you can know more than somebody, or you can be smarter, or you can be in many ways more prepared than someone, but then to see that that doesn't make you get the same level of attention or respect or acclaim, that was hard to take in. Because throughout most of my high school life, despite all the disparities and the things happening in the environment, in the city, there was a sense of meritocracy that was like, I felt like, you know, hey, I made the grades, I got there, I saw that. But when I came to Penn, it hit me that I really got to see, in a more personal way, privilege. Privilege is everywhere, and it was probably in many ways impacting my youth, clearly. But when I got to college, that was when I had real strong personal experiences with privilege and saw how classism and saw how in many ways, a lot of ways, racism magnified that in a space where you have all these great minds, mm-hmm. but the things that divided us wasn't necessarily our genius, but was more so about who had this money, whose daddy owned this company, who can get this internship. And it was all of that infighting that made me realize my purpose and what I do today. I feel like in Philly, there's more microaggressions, people who do subtle things that they don't realize. Like the first day I came to Penn, this boy who was in my grade, my year, basically was asking a ton of questions about my acceptance. And I didn't recognize what he was trying to imply. He was like, what is your SAT score? You know, what was your GPA? And just asking me these questions, interrogating me. And at the time, I really didn't understand what was going on, but he was trying to basically size up my admission and see if there was something, and then ask me, what role do you think affirmative action plays? And the nerve, because his father had went to Penn and his mother didn't. I'm like, well, you know, to be honest, if affirmative action is an unfair advantage, then you're definitely a beneficiary of affirmative action. But they don't call it that. They call you a legacy, which is this beautiful fancy word for nepotism. And there's a lot of that, right? Or, you know, if you're from New York or you're from the East Coast, the Ivy Leagues love to get a bunch of folks from the East Coast already here. Or they go through their, what I call, parent schools, where there's all these great sister school, private schools programs, where they just always are going to admit kids. I don't even know the last time they admitted someone who went to my actual high school. Because they're just not, you know? And a lot of kids from my high school probably never, don't even apply to Penn, because they don't see it on the resume, on the map.
Well, you know, I wanted to talk about, Ernest, some of your, how you're working now. And I think of what you do as really straddling old and new media. And you're kind of like chartering a new map. Like you do the investigative pieces, the op-eds, you're an LGBTQ editor for kind of an old school magazine, very old school print magazine, like the last of them.
Yes.
So it's, that alone is like this blending of new and old. So I want to talk about G Philly and what it's like to build a community online. You know, you've got your talk show that talks about race and class and gender and sexuality. And you're also a social media maven. So, I'm thinking about the Justin Timberlake conversation on Twitter. So there's all that. So I want to know, I think a lot about how so many of our institutions are crumbling. You know, there's all these, just media is one of them, where we're just like, the old is breaking and the new is yet to rise up in its place. And we're in this sort of weird middle place. And to see you as really navigating and charting and helping to create that new.
Absolutely.
So from your perspective, like what does that look like? What does that mean to you? What do you see?
Well, one of the important things that happened during my experiences is that I started to study politics and really observe what was going on. And I realized the role that the media had in really shaping those narratives. And I began to realize that the media has more power. They're the ones who pick our presidents. Like, when you think about how the media, like, played a role in Obama getting elected, I mean, he was on the cover of Rolling Stone. They made him a rock star. And that was magical. And I also saw the way the media kind of, in many ways, played a role with Trump getting so much press. And there was always this rule that whoever got the most media attention for any election wins the presidency. And I don't even know why people didn't realize, like, that because Trump got so much media attention, we were following the same trap. Whoever gets the most media attention wins the election. Whether it's bad or good press, we don't know. But he had the most media attention. And it was free press because, you know, I don't really remember seeing that many campaign flyers of him. But I just remember the fact that he was literally, every day, had a headline story. And clearly there was this desire to sensationalize him and really give him this platform, and that's how fascism happens. But that's another story. And, you know, just fell in love with the writing bug, and then the opportunity where Arianna Huffington came. She came as a connoisseur speaker at Penn, and she was looking for, they had a contest, basically, if you write 500 words about what you think about the media or something like that. I wrote it, and the winner would get a chance to get their piece, that piece published in HuffPost. When they had the online blog section, it was contributors. So I wrote it, and I won. I got to meet her. She gave me her card, and I gave her my card because that's what you do at Penn. Everyone carries a business card. So I got to meet her, and I emailed her the next day when the piece came out. I said, you know, thank you so much for this opportunity. I would love to write for y'all in the future, like one day, thinking one day. And it became, no, oh, if you would like, we can set you up an account. And at 21 years old, I was writing for the Huffington Post as a junior in college. And that really opened the door to this national presence. And so I started writing about pop culture, issues in movies and film and all these different things, and really began to build an audience on Twitter, especially at the time, and really started to think about, okay, there's something special happening here, and I need to create a lane for myself. I was doing a lot of entertainment stuff and tongue-in-cheek, and I still play around, do some pop culture writing, but I realized there was a bigger community, and there was something about a need for someone like me to be in that type of space, being Black, gay, coming from backgrounds of difference, mm-hmm. and telling those stories. There's plenty of Black gay men that do Hollywood reporting and red carpet stuff and fabulous and all that stuff. But I wanted to do something a little bit more serious. And, you know, I wouldn't say more important, but more serious, and something that I think spoke to other aspects of the experience that wasn't necessarily given to people with me on a platform. So I got into writing a column for the free paper at Metro. From there, got a lot of buzz and got to Philly Mag and became the LGBTQ editor. And it was really in that position that I was able to really change dialogue. Because see, when you're a writer, you tell stories, but what I tell people about the industry and the importance of diversity in the industry is that we don't need just Black writers and writers of color. We need to see them in editor positions. We need to see them in CEO positions. We need to see them making the calls. And when I was at Philly Mag, this was the first ever position where I was able to actually make the calls on content. So I got to choose the stories that was going to go through that channel. I'm able to, you know, say, this is the angle we want to go. This is the direction we want to go. And so when I got there, I was really, you know, had read a lot about Dr. Kimberly Crenshaw, who is the theorist who came up with the theory of intersectionality. And this understanding that our identities through race, religion, and culture, and class, especially gender, and race and the intersections of that is what gives us the nuance and what gives us this clarity and this understanding of how we interact. You can't just look in the experience of one cisgender heterosexual Black man and think that's the experience. But if you don't take into account the role that religion plays and sexual orientation does, then you're missing another part of the story. And so to me, that was missing in the coverage of LGBTQ life in Philadelphia. And I wanted to center that as the forefront of how we was going to do storytelling there. And that led to some groundbreaking investigative reporting I did on acts of racial discrimination in the LGBTQ community in Philadelphia, discrimination and transphobia, and all these other issues that oftentimes don't get to be front and center in our everyday news cycle. So to have it in a place like Philadelphia Magazine was important because the history of the magazine isn't necessarily reflective of those types of communities. And they have history. And when I got there, I came in the midst of a transformational period for the publication where they were thinking more forward about what they want the magazine to be. You know, when you say Philadelphia Magazine, you know, that what is Philadelphia to who? And the more that you have different voices and faces telling that Philadelphia story in that magazine every month, the better we are at it.
You've been very vocal in your critique of the intersections that you live in as a gay man in the black community, and you know, and the discrimination you face as a black man in the LGBT community. I pull out something that you wrote that really, I think, got to this point so beautifully. You said it, in a community that boasts acceptance and equality, the LGBT community as a whole has been stagnant, unraveling around other social justice issues that deeply impact a great number of its allies. Whereas other human rights groups at Ferguson or Baltimore, many LGBT organizations said or posted nothing about the queer people of color who might have been afflicted. And it's become more difficult to ignore the intersectionality that has colored my experience as a gay black man. In one sphere, I'm told that being black has nothing to do with being gay, and in the other, I'm reminded that race is irrelevant to the conversation. Both of these are lies, and as much as one community wants to act as though they are more accepting than the other, it's difficult for me to decide right now. It's so honest.
I remember that.
Yeah, I mean, talk about that. I feel in that this sense of betrayal might be a strong word, but loss or
betrayal.
Loneliness.
It is betrayal.
Yeah, talk about the emotions.
Disappointment.
Yeah.
And it's a part of the experience. Thinking about like the fact that every day when I'm out and I write pieces and I think about racism and I think about homophobia, I don't think about them on this totem pole of what's higher and what's better. I fight them with the same level of visceral reaction because they're who I am, it's who I am. And I think it's, what's daunting is that in a community where on both cases, you know, there needs to be healing, there needs to be inclusion for folks across both borders, shouldn't have to decide. It's not Sophie's choice, okay, where I have to say, take my gay side, just take it. Like, I recognize that more often than not, I do recognize that my blackness does in many ways supersede my queer identity. I do recognize that, and in many ways, I do find myself fighting a lot of times against the curse of racism than I do homophobia. However, what I have recognized is that despite my continued efforts to fight for my racial identity and to exist as a black man, I am fighting some unnecessary battles around my sexual orientation alongside the very people who identify with me racially. The tragedy of how white supremacy has played a huge role in dominating the LGBTQ narrative, because many of them have excluded people of color from the conversation, has erased trans women from the movement, even though they were the leading forces. You talked about Sylvia Rivera and Marsha P. Johnson, who she threw the first brick at Stonewall in the gay liberation movement. She's erased oftentimes from the conversation because we celebrate people like Harvey Milk, who is iconic and is an important part of the community, but we have erased the conversation of race. We've erased the conversation of race in this community. And so in many ways I am not seen. I don't feel like as if I exist oftentimes, and that I can't be a full person. I don't feel like I can fully, you know, when I go in certain spaces, I can't bring up that I have a partner, or all of a sudden the conversation feels irrelevant to those who are in the room who are black and heterosexual. But if I go in spaces that are LGBTQ spaces and I talk about how hard it is to walk in the street and be racially profiled, automatically someone is silencing that and dropping that and saying, oh, whoa, 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 you know, that's like homophobia. And I'm like, that's not the same as homophobia. That's not the same. And even though oppression hurts, there's different experiences based on different things. And when you are someone who carries both of those experiences, you can recognize the differences in the duality. You can recognize the difference in acceptance. I think what people ignore is that just because you come from a marginalized community in one sect doesn't mean that you automatically divorce yourself of other isms and other biases that you have. You have to work on those things. As a man, I work on what can I possibly be doing that could be sexist? What am I not seeing that someone else might be seeing? As someone who's ably bodied, I have to think about people that are disabled, you know, what kind of language am I using around people that are disabled, you know? As someone who does have a little bit of privilege now, that I have an Ivy League degree and I'm gainfully employed and I have my own business, I have equity, I have capital, I have social capital, I now have to think about people who don't have that and be more grateful and be mindful of the things that I say, you know? I remember one time I made a remark to someone that was like, you know, man, you know, I am starving, like I'm in Africa or something. I said something along those lines. And, you know, that person pushed back and said, wait a minute, like, you're being dramatic. Sure, you didn't probably eat something today, and that was a choice because you're working, but there are people who absolutely have no choice in access to food. And for you to be quick to, you know, allude to that, it's offensive. And to which I corrected that. And, you know, I recognized my privilege in that moment. And I think oftentimes we don't take the time to check ourselves or to get out of our own sect of issues to not recognize other groups. So no matter where you are in your life, you're never going to be able to embody all of the marginalizations of everybody. I recognize that I'm not a woman. I recognize that I'm not disabled. I recognize that I'm English speaking and I'm a US citizen. And I recognize those things. And the thing is that it's not to make your guilt trip yourself. It's more so to acknowledge these things and to be respectful and mindful of your positioning in different spaces. Mm-hmm. And that's what has been, I think, the hardest part in both communities and just throughout our country in general, is that we're oftentimes lacking empathy. We lack empathy. We can't take a step back to just recognize that the world is not centered always on us, mm-hmm. and that these issues that we experience are not necessarily always going to cater to our needs all the time. And I think that's how we saw the political division in this country. Many people put their own personal politics and their own personal insecurities to the forefront of the decisions they were making politically. And it cost a lot of people on the other side hurt.
Well, I want to, you know, it strikes me as something connected to what we talked about in the beginning when off camera, when you had shared, you get these, you know, two reactions to a lot of your writing.
Yes.
And I wonder, you know, around what you were saying around marginalization, and we, you know, no matter how, you know, you're somebody at the intersection of a couple different marginalized communities.
Yeah.
And you still have to work on your wokeness and your ability to empathize.
Yeah,
And I feel like folks that read you, you know, you're so honest, and very, you know, you don't hold back any punches, you know, you say how you feel.
Yeah.
And there's it feels like there's a defensiveness in, you know, white spaces or, mm-hmm. You know, cisgendered communities where, oh, you know, it's like an affront. But, you know, what do you hope, what stance could be helpful when we read or we process a different point of view?
Well, the first thing I always ask people is, what do you want? I think that's the hardest part, is I think people don't understand what do they want. If you know, when we talk about conversation about equality, this is the number one moment where people get a little shaken up. If we're in an unequal country, a country that has inequality, if we're in a world that is unequal, we know off top, if we can agree that things in this world is not fair, then there will have to be a reset of privilege and equity. And when we have that conversation about distribution of wealth, opportunities for jobs, everyone says they want those things, but it comes at a cost, okay? If you have an industry, okay, that is like Hollywood industry, right? You say it's predominantly white men that run that industry. If you ask some of those men, right, they'll say, I want diversity, I want difference. And you tell them, okay, the graph is at 80%. That means we're gonna have to cut this down a bit to spread open other groups to get that space. That's when the hit. That's when there's the conflict. No one wants to lose. No one wants to give up their privilege. They don't want to give up space. They don't want to share. And when you and the problem is there's people in the media and there's people that want to lie and say that everyone can win. And everyone can win because, but that will require a sacrifice that some people who are comfortable in their privilege and their access are not willing to do. And so a lot of what I write about says, you know, I was frank one time, I said, it's not about a seat at the table. Some people are gonna have to give up seats. If you're on a board and you say you wanna make your board diverse and you're not adding more numbers, someone's going to have to go. And then there's the fight of who goes and why. And then there's the argument, this illusion of meritocracy, I earned this. And then that keeps us at a gridlock where people really think that they earned something and then they don't wanna talk about privilege. And so people don't wanna talk about privilege when it comes to their privilege. They'll talk about it in a vacuum, they'll talk about it abstractly, but when they dig deep on their own individual assets and they have to really reevaluate what they have to take in and take out, they're afraid of that. And that to me is what's holding the conversation, because those who do feel an affront are those who feel like they are the most triggered in the fact that they will have to give something up and they're not emotionally ready to do that. And that's why I think progress in this country hasn't went as far as it could, because people are still, certain people that are privileged, that are more so privileged than others, are still holding back. Men are still holding back from opening doors to include women in the conversation. Straight people are still holding back from allowing the patriarchy to be disrupted with queer narratives. You know, there's a lot of that is holding on to these institutions that keep them fully in power. And it's a power dynamic and struggle. Mm-hmm. And it's a conversation of human character, essentially. Who is willing to let go of the power? Who is willing to amplify? Who's willing to make that commitment? And I don't think people are ready for that yet, which is why I think there are some people who read the work that are sober and say, you know what, I'm ready. I'm tired of fighting. I don't feel good about this. I don't like to see the division in that kind of way. I'm tired of seeing it. What does it take? If this is what it takes, then that's going to be better. Because that giving up is giving up to get to peace.
Yeah.
And we're I don't think people want that.
And I think having the vision of, you know, you talked about, you kind of alluded to this, like abundance mentality, like we can have it all, we all can have it all. And in the short, I think, yes, That's the utopian dream,
right.
But in one day, let's God willing, that will happen, and maybe not in my lifetime.
Right.
But you know, in the short term, what are the, you know, what's the vision? What's the dream? How can we help create narratives that really inspire us to be willing to make some of those really hard personal decisions that affect our personal privilege? You know, there has to be something that we understand that we're going to gain on the other side of that.
I mean, I think the reality is that, again, the truth of the matter is that until, you know, where we're at in this country, if there's a resistance movement happening, that the fighting will continue until it happens. And if you don't want to see this level of high stakes revolution that will in many ways come at the cost of dismantling institutions that could stay but won't stay because of the selfishness and the stubbornness, then you gotta start leveraging up and in doing it. I've seen organizations that I've covered go from having everything to losing it all because of that. I mean, if you look at what happened to Roseanne, is a good example. Roseanne, for whatever reason, couldn't let go of the bigotry and the things she said on social media and her ideology in a way that, unfortunately, a show that had great cast members and a great crew had to be the sacrificial lamb because they couldn't, she couldn't let go. So it came at the cost of an entire empire, right? And so I think that it becomes in where individuals have to look at these very tough parts and really look at that. Because I think we need to first, as a community, get and clean out the things we know to be wrong. There are things that we see and we know are wrong, and we have to speak up about it. We have to speak out about it. If we're silent to the things we know are wrong, then we are never going to progress as a community or as a country to the things that we still have to figure out. And so I think there's a lot of dead giveaways, right? There's a lot of things that we're like, this is just not a good system, right? The criminal justice system, there are issues there. There needs to be reform. There needs, no, not just reform, there needs to be an entire shakeup. And we all know that, right? And we all see things in our city that are like just not fair, and certain policies and things. And even in the state of Pennsylvania, there is currently, right now, there's no anti-discrimination policy for LGBTQ folks statewide. Now in Philadelphia, I live in Philly, we have the Fair Practice Ordinance. I am okay. If someone tried to fire me because I was gay, they would be fired. But if I was to go to Elizabethtown or some other small town in Pennsylvania, I could get married because of the Supreme Court. But if I go to work, I could get married on Saturday, go to work on Sunday, I mean, I go to work on Monday with a picture of my partner and I on my desk, and if the employer saw that and wanted to fire me because of, he could. And so this is that in that disproportionate balance here, where you get some progress, but then you don't get something else. And so we have to fight against that. Like, if we can all agree that marriage equality was something that the country needed, then we need to say it's not enough of marriage equality. We need total equality, and we need to fight that. Because the more we do that collectively, the more we stand up for each other on things we know to be true, the easier it becomes for everyone. And so the gain is that you want a peace of mind, because, and you also recognize that we have to all work with each other. If someone else in the community is oppressed, the community as a whole suffers, the village suffers. You can't ever walk in a world and be so selfish and privileged to say, I'm doing fine, so as long as I'm fine, it's all cool, because we all know that line is, first they came for this person, and then they came for this. It's too much going on. The country is coming for immigrants. They start with immigrants, and then they will definitely come for people of color. And they'll just keep working their way up, and then there'll be no women. And then there'll literally just be white, straight men. And that are Christian. So, Lord forbids that we get to that point. And I think we just have to come to a place to understanding that anyone that's being oppressed is a threat to my own survival.
I want to talk about, a little bit about a nuance that we didn't touch on in our earlier conversation. The concept of internalizing oppression, you know, when you look at your marginalized communities, where, you know, you mentioned your folks of your community of color, your community of LGBT, and the internalized oppression that you know, clearly happens. As a woman, I know, you know, you've realized you've taken a bath in this kind of comes patriarchy, and you know, you can't believe you're thinking these things until you catch it. How do you think that plays a role in, does that play a role in, you know, in keeping other groups marginalized? Is that a factor?
I think partially. But again, it goes to the overall arching systems that kind of program this in us, right? 53 to 54% of white women voted for Donald Trump to be president, despite him having some of the most historically, the most publicly, openly sexist remarks during his campaign. Clearly, there was people in office that did things that were inappropriate during their presidency that wasn't too keen on both sides. But in our current administration, you know, when we talk about that type of internalized oppression, I think a lot of it does shape in the fact of how society views you. If you're consuming content and media that devalues you every day, eventually you devalue, you can easily devalue yourself if you don't, you know, decolonize your mind. You know, you have to decolonize your mind in a way that, you know, for me, that was why it was important to be an LGBTQ editor. Because the stories I saw about LGBTQ life in Philly did not look like my life, did not look like the life of my friends and people that I knew and I cared about. It was very much so sexualized and stereotyped in ways that's like, oh, you know, first of all, it was mostly all white men. I don't know why they kept saying LGBTQ, because the only thing you saw was the G. You never saw really any L, you definitely saw any T. B is invisible in the conversation. And maybe Q, if the white guy decides that he wants to say he's queer or questioning, whatever. That wasn't what was going on. And so for me, it was about changing that narrative. And it was special because the other day, this guy, I did an interview, I did a section that I always do called LGBTQ&A. Yes, we love acronyms in the community. So I put, you know, this is LGBTQ&A, because, you know, the Q in LGBTQ is questioning. And people always think it's queer, it's questioning. And so it was like questioning and answering, you know, kind of Q&A. So I did that Q&A. And he talked about his experiences with his acceptance and suicide and things like that. And there were people who read that and said, wow, I can identify with this person. Mm-hmm. And reading this person's story made me think about my entire life a different way. Mm-hmm. Because that touched me in a different way and made me feel more confident or realize I'm not alone. But they had never read any stories that had people that looked just like them coming from where you're from. He lives in Lancaster, which is very different from Philadelphia. And so he is navigating this space being queer, being open, you know, going and working and the microaggressions he experiences. And that has given him, sometimes he went through depression and things. And so I interviewed him, he told his story and he felt open. And there were other people who began to reach out to him and say, yo, I read your story, I can connect. And so, people seeing other people and understand there's pain here takes out a lot of the fang of people feeling as though, wow, you know, I'm not this pariah, I'm not this outsider as much as I think. And so we have to really project different images and conversations about ourselves, because oftentimes LGBTQ people on media are loveless or they're completely promiscuous. They're completely sidekicks, or they're completely missing from the entire story. And I wanted to, at least in my community, in my space, help tell stories of different types of people that are real life heroes that actually exist, that people can celebrate and admire, whether it was activist groups like the Black and Brown Workers Cooperative, or whether it was, you know, wonderful women, trans women like, you know, this woman named Sharon Cooks, who was the first openly trans commissioner of any citywide commission in the country. And her story from going from, you know, being a sex worker to now going to Temple to get her master's, and she was at the DNC as a delegate, and how literally she has embodied all of these different experiences. Someone needs to read that story, because the story that was out about trans women was always death stories. And at G Philly, what was important to me was changing that, where that will be the internalization. Like, if you're reading nothing, if you was a trans, black trans woman, and you looked at most of the news, all you saw were death stories. So you were internalizing this expectancy to die. And at G Philly, it was important to me to say, we need to talk about people while they're living. We need to act and stop putting death sentences on people through statistics only. And so I made it a point to interview as many trans people who are doing incredible work and living and saying, you will live, because I know the history of how it was with HIV and AIDS. We saw an epidemic come in the early 90s, and there was nothing but death stories. Yeah. And the more living stories, the more people internalize this idea that I will live through this, they live.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about, you touched on stories and men. I want to talk about mentoring. I understand that you volunteer in some inner city schools in Philly, providing media training and mentorship to high school students. So I want to talk about, you know, the role mentors played in your life coming up, what you're doing now, and what's the importance and relationship with the students? What are you doing? And kind of touch on all of that.
Oh, definitely. Well, mentors have always been a part of my life. My mentors come from family. My grandmother, who's no longer living in the present, she played a very big role in my life. I was mentored by so many elders. Growing up, every summer I used to go to Marion, Arkansas, which is a small town, which is not too far from Texas. So my mother used to always take me to Mariana. My grandmother, I spent the summer with her, my great-great-grandfather, or my great-grandfather, who, you know, had this this small house, and literally there was no McDonald's, there was no Walmart, there was like nothing. We had one Sonic, that was it. But that was it, just a Sonic. And that was so exciting back then, ooh, you know, because there was like nothing else. And I learned a lot about living just with what you have and appreciating that calmness of this life, this rural life of like things, the everyday things were events. You know, the joy of like the biggest thing of the day is that we're going to cook supper, and that's going to be the biggest thing of the day. Not whose email, whose call, who has a cell phone, who's doing this. It was these experiences with peace that like to this day is plays an important role in my life. Mm-hmm. Like this idea of, I mean, my life has been hectic. I have a great media career. There's a lot of action, but I still take joy in the subtleties. Like the other day, I enjoyed, like I was experimenting with making drinks, liquor, a gin and tonic with elderflower. And I'm just like into cocktail making. And that's another story. But I fell into the simplicities of like, that's what I'm doing today. I'm just going to make the best cocktail that I'm going to experiment. I'm looking forward to running to the store and getting it. Or just those subtle moments of like growing up and going to church and going to a family member's house or going to a funeral or preparing for a funeral and these subtleties. And this area was a bunch of mostly senior citizens who just lived their life and they reflected on their life and the calmness and the pace of like nothing like the like living in a space where it's just not chaotic, or that the purpose of life isn't so much as this ambition, but just living and just taking that time and that space. And that was very young, like experiencing that. And so where I'm at now, and like clearly that's not my life now, but I reflect on those type of values and things, and sometimes I'm like, it doesn't always have to be glamorous. It doesn't have to always be flash. And sometimes it's okay to have one or two friends for dinner and just enjoy the view. Because I'm actually in an industry where I'm pretty young in my spaces. Like Philly Mag does not have too many people my age that look like me. And most of the people I work with are old enough to be my parents. Everyone I work with, like I'm in a space where I'm writing beside these greats, these legends that have been in the business for as long as I've been alive. And so that has made me realize also too, from learning from them, is that you're never too old to mentor and inspire someone. So, you know, there's people that, you know, in my friend circle, like, oh, you know, I gotta be 30. I have to have the biggest car, the biggest house. The youth, especially the black and brown youth in public schools in this city in Philadelphia, they need heroes now. They need people to look up to, heroines, people to admire, that are in positions that can, you know, inspire them to keep going. I tell people, you being a college graduate alone will make an, you know, just graduating from college has a level of expertise that can help to someone who's about to enter college.
What motivated you to start working with those students?
What made me motivated is because I didn't have too many people that I saw that looked like me, that identified as myself, that was active. Most of the people who was coming out to us were older reverends and clergy and older men, and they were great, they were wonderful, but it's like, it would have been cool to see, and I think I'm more so excited to see more younger millennials especially start picking up the philanthropy and the community service. I feel like our generation is starting to do more of that now, and a lot of my friends are going back to schools now and mentoring, because I think there was this period where people always thought you had to be established, you had to already be with the credentials to go to school and then teach, but now it's changed because we're realizing that they're identifying with people that's around their age. I can control it. I can control the classroom a lot differently than someone that's like 20 years older than me. I can walk in a room and because I look like I have a brother that's 8 years old and a 15-year-old brother. So there's nothing that can slide through my nose. I'm very aware of the apps and all the little things that's going on. So there's this automatic sense of already respect that, and there's already this cultural connection. And I think more of that needs to happen in the learning process in addition to, you know, older, you know, more seasoned professionals coming in. But there has to be more of a cross-generational mentorship. That was something that was very good for me. Like I had, when I was in college, I had a lot of seniors and people that was in grad school that was also giving me advice in my career. I think mentorship cannot just be this idea of the superior elder and this younger person. It has to be different people that's playing a role, a big brother or someone that's playing that role. And that's the role I play with my brothers. Like, I am definitely big brother. And I take that role very seriously.
That's really neat to hear that you're seeing that in the millennial generation. You're really seeing them taking on the mantle of mentorship and kind of recreating the model of not just the top down.
And I think it's because of like things like Teach for America and programs. It's like putting younger people out into spaces where they need to work because the economy is just like crazy. So people are going back and teaching. Maybe they want to, maybe they don't. But they're starting off very much so. I know a lot of my friends who have done programs like Teach for America and then they'll go to law school and become a lawyer, but they had their first 2 years motivating and inspiring a group of kids.
Because you've been critical of both groups that you intersect, LGBT and Black community, I, as a white straight ally, I wonder how much personally are you risking? It feels like you're risking a good bit of your own privilege by talking out, saying truth to power, you know, in both of these groups. And that's and I'm watching you do that. And I'm like, he is putting himself on the line in both of his communities. And what does that mean for me? And what does that give me courage to do? So I wonder, do you ever feel isolated? Do you ever feel scared to say these things?
Yes. So, you know, there was a time and, there's still moments where, not as much anymore. I think I'm starting to see the harvest and the come up of a lot of what I'm doing because I think people want it. I think, you know, the bittersweetness of Trump being elected is that in many ways it unveiled the realities that I've often spoke about even before Trump got elected. And people are more than ever craving that. They're craving this truth. People want the truth more than ever. I think more than ever the truth needs to be protected. And I think we're seeing that there are people that are detractors of the truth. We're seeing people are adamantly trying to keep and misinform people. And I think people are really bucking against that and resisting against that. And I think people like me who've been out here being truth slayers and telling the truth and telling it how it is, we're getting amplified more because we're needed more. And so I do feel like now I am happy I stuck with journalism, that I've continued to do it because I'm starting to really see the fruits of my labor being harvested in, as far as being able to connect with more people and get this message out. That being said, when I was first starting, there was hurdles. I mean, I'm 26 years old. This was a risk. Like, you know, you get this Ivy League degree, you get into these networks of people, and, you know, I could have downplayed my sexual orientation. I could have really towed that line, and I would have probably been making way more money than I make now. And I'm happy with how I live and not what I have. Sure. But I think about it sometimes and say, man, if I was in the closet and I was this nice, well-spoken, educated, you know, if I was an Obama-type guy in presentation, I would be in Wall Street right now, I'd be making money, I would probably be on some great lists, I would have probably made the Times list, I would have been on the under 30 list, I would have been so much celebrated because that is safe. Being safe, I get it. Playing safe and being safe in this world comes with its own rewards. But I had to tell myself, if I went to bed at night, would I be happy? Would I be actually happy, right? Like, these are all worldly possessions, but they don't have actual merit and impact. So the sacrifice, I guess, was a state of personal peace or a state of public peace. And the public peace is what most of us and many of us are programmed to divorce ourselves of our own joy and personal experiences. Mm-hmm. And I said to myself, if this was a life worth living, I spent an entire childhood and you know, downplaying and being in a closet. And life is not guaranteed. And I was not going to, and I also had a lot of people I knew who were also in a closet that came out at 50. You know, people who haven't came out. And in being LGBTQ at LG Philly, I've done a lot of stories of interview people that are, you know, elderly that are coming out for the first time. People who, you know, won't come out for whatever reasons, and seeing this sense of quiet desperation that I remember I felt when I was younger, and feeling like I can never come out and things, but that loathing, and the people who died and committed suicide because they felt like they just, this world they was living in was not accommodating for them. Mm-hmm. You know, I talk to my mom often, you know, she knows me in and out, and she understands, you know, the you know, and it's, you know, natural motherly things, right? Like the idea of like, did you tweet too much? How are you gonna handle this? And she's genuinely protective of me.
Is Justin Timberlake gonna come after you?
Right. You know, and she's genuinely protective of me, but very much so supportive, and recognizes that there is a method in the madness. Before other people could worry about how I was gonna make it as being openly gay, some of my friends and family who was like, you know, some of my family members who were like, you know, is this gonna be okay? What's gonna happen? You know, they were just worried about me navigating, like, could I get a job? You know, even, you know, all these things. And I said, look, this is my life. First and foremost, I have to take control of this and take control of my life and fight for this. And I fought a fight and I've been able to succeed. And I wanna do that because I wanna inspire other people in my circumstances. There's always this idea that we're always told, people who are, whatever the case may be, that are outspoken people, there's always this idea that, you know, if you be outspoken, you're out, and you're this and you're that, you're not going to make it. And in many cases, there are some people that don't. But there are also people who do, and they do it, and they do it well. And that is something that was really important to me, being able to say, look, there was a lot of people who told me growing up, especially in this industry, you know, I need to, you know, lay low key. I can't even downplay this shirt right now. I'm myself. This is who I am. And rather than I change for the world, I'm banking on the world changing their views. And the world has changed in many ways. There's some things that are regressive, but the world is beginning to change because people like me are challenging them. I'm forcing people to change. I'm debunking them. Who's going to be here? I mean, the thing is, who's going to be here to tell people they're wrong and to change if everyone is too busy being complicit and silent? If we know something is wrong, we have to speak out. And I felt like it was the vision of my grandmother and the people I, you know, grew up under, that they lived a life where, you know, from the civil rights era all the way down, that they had to speak up. And they didn't have college degrees and they didn't have money, but they recognized that something was wrong and they had to say something. And that has been something that has carried me on throughout my entire life, is this need and this obligation, this moral calling that you have to say something and that you can't be sitting idly by.
If you'd like to learn more from Ernest Owens, follow him on Twitter at Mr. Ernest Owens. Check out his website and his work for Philadelphia Magazine. Links to everything can be found at our website, 3ms.co. And while you're there, subscribe to our mailing list so you never miss a story from us.